Hello and welcome to another news episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast. We explore the intersection of traditional finance, digital money and digital assets and help you understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Michael Blaschke, and today it's time for another news episode. Today we look back to the month of June and discuss what we deem the most relevant developments in the institutional DLT space. To this, I am joined by our co-host Manuel Klein. Hi, Manu.
Hi, Michi. Good to see you again after the physical meeting in Point Zero, or at Point Zero Forum in Zurich.
Yeah, that was lovely. We're actually right back in our offices after both Manu and I and other co-hosts joined the Point Zero Forum. So stay tuned on that because we plan to certainly look back on the Point Zero Forum too. For today, we look back on the news of June and we're going to cover today in a market section first that June was a brutal month for crypto, with the total market cap sliding down to 2 trillion, Bitcoin and Ethereum both in deep red. Then we move on to the money side of things with stable coins still going mainstream, MoneyGram, Bancomat, SoFi's first bank-issued coin, and the giants are also circling. MasterCard, Stripe, and Visa are reportedly building settlement rails that could revive banking as we know it today. And in a third section, we close with the fight that then decides it all: regulation, the ECB versus stablecoins, Europe reporting a reopening, MiCA and Washington's Clarity Act gaining ground increasingly. So we're going to cover markets, money, and the race of the future all in the next 60 minutes. Let's get into it. So let's look on the markets. The last 30 days were rough across the board. Total crypto market cap fell roughly 18% to around $2 trillion, with Bitcoin down 22% and Ethereum off more than 24% in June. The backdrop is a cooling crypto cycle and a clear capital rotation toward AI, with Bitcoin trading less like a safe haven and more like a high-frequency liquidity gauge. But there are interesting signals underneath all that price action. Strategy, for example, is selling Bitcoin for the first time since 2022. BlackRock is talking up a $9 trillion redeployment while launching a yield engineering ETF, and Vitalik Buterin is repositioning privacy as a native Ethereum property to meet institutional demands. Meanwhile, gold ticked up and equities held roughly flat, reinforcing the crypto drains first thesis that so many promote. Yeah. Let's run a bit through the market details. So as I said, the crypto market in total ended in $2 trillion, which is a minus 18%. Bitcoin itself started the month at $72,000, ended it on below 60,000, so minus 20%. And the Bitcoin ETF's total asset under management are at around $82 billion. Yeah, so much about the numbers. We are recording in the middle of what is to me, by any honest definition, a bear market. Yeah, Bitcoin printed an all-time high around $126,000 last October. It then fell to roughly $60,000 in February. It clawed its way back into the low 80s in May and then rolled over again. And we sit here, it's hovering around the $60,000 mark, and frankly, a lot of the attention that used to flow into crypto is now all flowing into AI. Let's wait for what ends this current bear market. And now, looking below the numbers, or underneath the numbers, on some of the interesting market movements, and certainly number one topic in the space was Saylor and Strategy selling 32 Bitcoin. So that made really a lot of noise in the space relative to its actual size. In late May, Michael Saylor's Strategy sold 32 Bitcoin. That's about $2.5 million. at an average just above 77,000. He sold it, disclosed in an 8K filing. Now, against a treasury of 843,000 coins, so 843,000 coins, that is really a rounding error, something like 0.004%. And yet the scene completely lost its mind because this is the man whose entire brand is never sell your Bitcoin. Yeah, he even tweeted exactly this statement, that is, never sell your Bitcoin, back then in Germany in 2024 when Saxony was offloading its seized coins. Yeah, now all of a sudden this guy says Bitcoin. Yeah, that really made a lot of noise. And here's why I think that this is more symbolism than actual substance. So Saylor told us exactly why he did it, actually. He framed this as vaccinating the market. So providing that Bitcoin on a corporate balance sheet is liquid and monetizable, that you can actually access the value when you need to as an entrepreneur to service your preferred share dividends. And for our audience, now, people sitting in treasury, in risk, in IT, inside financial institutions. That's the sophisticated reading to me. So a credit-financed treasury model has to demonstrate to rating agencies and credit analysts that the asset on the balance sheet is real, usable, collateral, not only a religious relic you can never touch. So actually, I find it cool that Saylor proved, when you need some liquidity, you sell your Bitcoin and off you go. So it's just a pragmatical use of an asset on the balance sheet. But the market really expected him to never sell really at not the smallest amount of Bitcoin, and then really went crazy. Yeah. Then a second interesting market signal was around Jack Mellers and the smoke alarm, if you will, yeah? Which takes us neatly to more of a macro story. Yeah? Because if Saylor is here the micro picture of selling 32 Bitcoin with his, which is nothing for him, Jack Mellers is now the macro one. So Mellers, the Strike CEO, now also running 21 Capital, has been arguing that Bitcoin's weakness isn't a Bitcoin problem at all. It's a fiat problem. Actually, his line is that Bitcoin is a quote-unquote smoke alarm for liquidity stress in the traditional system. So when central banks tighten or simply refuse to expand their balance sheets, liquidity drains, and Bitcoin being the most liquid 24/7 globally traded asset there is, feels it first. So we're bringing this here because Mellers really brought an interesting thesis on why the Bitcoin price is so low and we are in this bear market. His signature phrase is one every trader already knows among you. So you sell what you can, not what you want, end of quote. And that's the hallmark of forced liquidation and the decoupling he points to is real. So when Bitcoin sells off hard while equities hold steady, that's somebody meeting a margin call by dumping the asset with the deepest order book. Now, where I'd push back to Mellers is this is the European monetary theory angle I like on the show. Mellers is essentially describing Bitcoin as a high-frequency liquidity gauge rather than a store of value. And that's a double-edged claim. So if Bitcoin is the smoke alarm, then it's structurally the first thing sold in stress, which is almost the opposite of the digital gold pitch we heard for years. So yeah, so really look into this super interesting thinking and piece on an explanation of why we are in a bear market in crypto. And then ultimately also about Bitcoin, BlackRock's $9 trillion US dollar call and the BITA or beta launch. Yeah. This where does the liquidity go next question is exactly the one BlackRock just walked into. So Rick Rieder, their global fixed income CIO, told Bloomberg there's up to $9 trillion of cash sitting on the sidelines. So exactly the counter thesis to Jack Mellers here. So roughly 7 trillion in money markets funds, another 2 trillion in fixed income ETFs. And he expects an explosive redeployment once the Fed starts easing. He even publicly leaned on the new Fed chair, Kevin Warsh, to hold off on hikes. Yeah. So in comparison to the Jack Mallers thesis that we are in a liquidity crisis, BlackRock is rather bullish here with a bullish prediction for the Bitcoin prices. Now, also briefly looking on the Ethereum, we started the month for the Ethereum around $2,100, ended it on $1,500, which is a minus 25% price dump. Ethereum ETFs currently holding $14 billion totally under management. And the most interesting piece of news regarding Bitcoin was Vitalik Buterin on Ethereum's privacy pivot. I think this is actually a more strategically important for this month. Vitalik Buterin posted on where Ethereum and the Ethereum Foundation are going. Because while everyone else is talking about price, but particularly about Bitcoin and Ethereum price, Buterin is now making a or intends to making privacy a native protocol level property of Ethereum's layer one rather than something you add on other levels or through other means. Yeah. And his argument is quite striking. So strong privacy is what gives Ether genuine moneyness, the qualities of physical cash, as he puts it. He puts a concrete roadmap behind it. So account abstraction combined with fork, Joy's enforced inclusion lists to make it impossible for block builders to censor private transactions. So much about potentially price moving news for Ethereum.
To add maybe one point, Michi, on Ethereum, I mean, what was striking is that so many quite senior people left the Ethereum Foundation, right? And that Vitalik really reacted with this very, very long post on Twitter where he explained again where he believes Ethereum should be developing into with now a strong push into privacy. I think it's now technologically feasible. It seems technologically feasible that even the main net really goes all in into privacy and deploying new protocols on the network to ensure privacy, which is still the missing piece on public blockchains, right? So he tries to explain again why he believes Ethereum is obviously still important when so many senior colleagues from the Ethereum Foundation are leaving.
Exactly. My take on this whole privacy move is that Buterin and the Ethereum Foundation are explicitly answering institutional demands. So serious on-chain adoption by banks, asset managers, corporates, and I really heard that at the Point Zero Forum. It simply cannot happen on a fully transparent ledger where every counterpart can see your positions and flows. So confidential transactions are a precondition, not a nice to have. And this lands directly on top of Europe's whole agenda, like data protection, GDPR, digital sovereignty. So while the US conversations about wrapping Bitcoin in ever fancier ETF structures, the Ethereum conversations moving toward the privacy and confidentiality properties that European institutions have been demanding for years. That's an interesting contrast. Let's see if that turns out to be true, that these privacy aspects really serve the institutional demand. Yeah, so much about Bitcoin and Ethereum and some potentially price-moving signals behind the unfortunately deep red month for crypto. There are also some news-related interesting investments and fundraising in the tokenization and institutional infrastructure space. Yeah, so quite some money flew into tokenization infrastructure this month. 4 deals stand out, and together they show capital moving toward the plumbing of regulated on-chain finance. First, we see a global network buying into European regulatory infrastructure, that is Stellar and Cashlink. We see 2 protocols hitting a $2 billion valuation the same week from opposite philosophical corners. One, privacy and permissioning versus openness and composability, that is Canton and Morpho. And we see a Wall Street incumbent partnering with a crypto exchange to put New York Stock Exchange equities on chain, that is ICE and OKX. Yeah. So the investors are increasingly also the users and operators, and the action is concentrating where regulatory clarity and institutional demand intersect, which is kind of a no-brainer, because if you have regulatory clarity and institutional demand, things can move. Probably another learning from the Point Zero Forum. Yeah. So let's run quickly through them and start with Stellar and CashLink. So let's start at home, Manu, in Frankfurt at the Stellar Development Foundation, took a strategic stake in CashLink Technologies. Now, for our audience, this is the one to really pay attention to, because CashLink is Germany's most active registrar for digital securities. They are licensed both as a crypto Wertpapier Registerführer, sorry for that mouthful, and they are licensed as a crypto custodian, and they operate under the EWPG, the German Electronic Securities Act. And that legal frame is the whole point under this EWPG, so a DLT-based issuance can dispense with the classic central securities depository altogether and instead use a blockchain-native register as the legal record of ownership. And that is not a technical convenience. It's really a more structural change to how securities settlement works in Germany. And that's why we also brought it today. So the CSD, which has sat at the center of European capital markets for a long time, now becomes optional. And CashLink has the traction to back it up. Yeah, so more than 300 live issuances, around 850 million euros in volume, heading toward the 1 billion mark, and the client list that is genuinely tier one: Deutsche Bank, KfW or KfW, DZ Bank, Helaba. This is a US-born, globally reaching network, Stellar buying into European regulatory infrastructure, not the other way around. At least this is my take. And the licensees and the EWPG framework are the moat, and everyone now understands that the regulated register is a scarce asset.
Definitely congratulations to CashLink, to Michael Duttlinger and the whole team. I find it very interesting that Stellar now really also invests into these infrastructure players. Stellar has been on the rise, I would say, again, right? Especially with a tokenization and some institutional adoption. So very interesting to also follow where the Stellar network ends up. So far, Stellar has not been used also here in Europe widely for issuing tokenized bonds or tokenized securities in general. So yeah, quite interesting to see how that will, and how the Stellar Development Foundation might also help to reach the next level, right? Yes, 300 issuances live. It sounds very good, but obviously 350 million euro volume outstanding, or tokenized volume for tokenized securities, is still minuscule when you compare it to major issuances, right? So only the Siemens bond alone was 300 million, but that was also deemed quite small, especially for this large organization. So let's see how this investment can help CashLink also to reach the new, more ambitious targets and issuance volume.
All right, and to wrap up the market sections, let me drop a final interesting piece of market investments. In June also, Digital Asset closed a $315 million Series F led by A16Z Crypto at roughly $2 billion valuation. The investor list actually is the story to me. So alongside the crypto funds, you have BNP, BNP Paribas, HSBC, ABN AMRO, Citadel Securities, S&P Global, Tradeweb, and so on. There is the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority and then Coinbase Ventures and Polychain on the crypto side. So this is a who is who of Wall Street and European banking now writing checks into a single network. So that's why it's important to me to bring this one up.
And yeah, just to add, Digital Asset has this, its Canton network, right? And Canton is gaining more and more momentum It was also a big topic at the Point Zero conference to talk about. I personally also need to look again deeper into Canton, what is really happening there. But yeah, the DTCC wants to bring all its tokenized securities on Canton, right? And it's really focusing on privacy first with regards to institutional adoption. I think at the moment I talked to the head of RWA of Canton Point Zero Forum as well. It's really around DeFi, so they have a few decentralized exchanges and lending protocols. Well, also USDC is used, wrapped ETH is deployed, but I think they're really eyeing for institutional adoption. And yeah, as you say, the investor list is quite impressive, BNP Paribas, HSBC, ABN AMRO, but then also other FMIs that really want to bring float on Canton now. Yeah, so we will definitely follow further where this leads.
Brilliant. So let's move from markets to money and look at stablecoin launches and the adoption of innovative emerging alternative payment rails.
Yeah, thanks, Michi. There's also quite a lot that has happened over the last month here in June. And we're going to start with some remittance flows because MoneyGram, and we've been discussing this, they plan to issue their own stablecoin, and now they have done that also on Stellar. Yeah, so talking about Stellar, which had secured this stake in Cashlink. Obviously, they are also a high-performance blockchain that can very quickly settle, and this is why MoneyGram has also chosen Stellar for its global payment network. So they launched MGUSD, a native US dollar stablecoin, built to power its own global payments network that is used for remittance. They really upgrade their existing infrastructure, the existing remittance infrastructure and business with stablecoins now. It should become a Genius Act compliant stablecoin when it goes live. M0 is handling the mint burn processes via smart contracts, and Fireblocks provides the custody and the wallet infrastructure. It will launch first in the US and will be directly embedded into the MoneyGram app via a self-custodial wallet. Quite interesting. So, Fireblocks helping to provide the wallet infrastructure, but self-custodial wallets directly in the existing MoneyGram app. And MoneyGram has been already partnering 5 years with the Stellar Development Foundation to now bring out this stablecoin. And what I think is interesting is that this is really now a rebuild of the infrastructure, of the legacy remittance infrastructure of MoneyGram, and they really bet on this new infrastructure and this new type of money, a stablecoin that can obviously be moved very efficiently across borders. It really signals this further adoption from financial infrastructure players like MoneyGram that has been powering remittance, obviously, for quite a while already. Interestingly enough, here it's not using an existing stablecoin but creates its own, therefore wants to create the yield themselves. And it's really a distinct use case for this stablecoin, which is KYC'd only clients, which are clients of MoneyGram, that can then hold this stablecoin in their wallet directly. So it's a very distinct use case for this stablecoin, interestingly here. So we're going to focus on the adoption here and the figures over the next months and years while it scales up. But I think also stablecoins is a quite, or remittance rather, is a quite good use case for stablecoins that we've been talking about quite a lot already. So curious to follow that. And there's another news update from a new project around stablecoin issuance, which is Bancomat, which is Italy's national debit card network. So you can think about it when you're in Germany, there's the Girocard, or in France, the Carte Bancaire, so a domestic card scheme. And a Bancomat also issues a domestic card scheme and has a vast ATM network. And they're now also issuing, or they want to issue their EUR bank stablecoin, which is directly plugged in into the banking system of the 9 major Italian banks that are backing it. So it's Intesa San Polo, Banco BPM, Monte dei Paschi, Banca Sella, Credit Agricole Italia, and a few others. So essentially most of Italy's banking establishment. And quite interestingly, three of these pilot banks, Banca Sella, BPR Banca, and Intesa San Paolo, are also backing Kivalis, the stablecoin project of 37 European banks. So they now also go with another project here, where they target a public launch for late 2026 or early 2027, pending regulatory approval. So it could eventually also be a bit faster than the Kivalis stablecoin. Let's see which project lands first. Yeah, quite interestingly here, this will be issued by Flowpay, which is an open banking fintech Bancomat acquired last August, where those banks obviously are also joint shareholders. There's no separate consortium, so everything will be run through Bancomat's existing governance framework. And this fintech that has already been acquired last August. Another interesting fact is that the reserves will sit entirely in cash, so entirely in deposits that are custodied pro rata across the distributed banks. So no government bonds backing the stablecoin, but rather directly deposits with those banks. And a bank that distributes 20 million of the token then also holds the 20 million of reserves. So there's an incentive to ultimately distribute this token and therefore then also receive the reserves, where there's the NII, the net interest income, to be earned. So quite an interesting move again here from the banking industry, from the European banking industry, that is doubling down on euro-denominated stablecoins.
I think two interests there. It fits into two patterns that we increasingly observe. Number one is banks prefer the consortium model. I mean, Kivalis is just another example. We've mentioned other examples here on how banks team up to launch stablecoins. And the second pattern that emerges is the question around yet another stablecoin. Yeah, it always makes me kind of smile. One, it's cool that new stablecoin projects are launched. On the other hand, who needs another stablecoin, in particular euro stablecoin? So we see European denominated stablecoins or euro-backed stablecoins struggle, not capturing market share. And yet, at least Bancomat or the bank consortium here, I think that yet another European stablecoin can be promising.
Yeah, and what didn't come out clearly from at least the press release and the articles that I found is the concrete use case that they want to target, right? Is there a concrete use case that they want to target? I don't think this is publicly announced yet. So the question is, will it be like a permissionless stablecoin that can be used in any other DeFi protocol? Is that what these banks aim for, right? Or which other use case are they focusing on? Domestic use case with euros and instant payments being unlimited now, being able to reach obviously also every Italian bank, I still struggle a bit. But let's see how that succeeds. Quite interesting, especially for these three banks that are also invested in Kivalis, how those two stablecoins will also compete with each other. So we'll definitely have an eye on that. Other news brought out also here, MasterCard, the obviously major credit card company clearing billions every day, they also now want to extend their settlement capabilities to stablecoins for intraday, holiday, and weekend options. So they announced that they want to use now or want to offer settlement with stablecoins, which gives obviously the issuers and the acquirers flexibility when and how they settle card transactions, in particular for cross-border payments and payouts where timing and transparency matter. That will allow intraday payouts and again on weekends and public holidays as well. They don't restrict their settlement to specific stablecoins, but rather say they support Circle's USDC. Then Paxos issued stablecoins like PYUSD, which is the PayPal stablecoin, USDG, USDP, and Ripple's RLUSD, and actually also now SoFi's new stablecoin, SoFi USD. They support multiple blockchains as well, Arbitrum Base, Canton, Ethereum, Polygon, Solana, Tempo as well, and XR PL. So it's rather really a broad chain approach and a broad stablecoin approach. And they've already secured a few users as well. CrossRiver and Lead Bank, they are two US banks that are quite actively partnering with stablecoin issuers and the whole crypto space in general. And Nuvei as well, which is an acquiring firm that will among the first to use the settlement mechanism in the US and Latin America. And MasterCard wants to roll this out globally. So why is this interesting? Obviously, this is a completely new infrastructure that is now really adopted. Again, also here after Visa has announced similar steps by MasterCard. So really using this new rail as plumbing, so to say, to settle transactions via their card networks. And how does it work? The consumer or the merchant side is rather untouched. So the cardholder swipes with its traditional card, then the authorization happens, and then the transaction clears in fiat currencies or account-based money, exactly as before. Nothing about the checkout ultimately changes, but the stablecoin rather purely sits in the interbank settlement leg, where then here the issuer and the acquirer can then choose to fund a settlement obligation in stablecoins instead of a wire transfer. So ultimately, the issuer holds stablecoins, transfers these stablecoins to meet its obligations rather than sending a regular wire transfer. And the acquirer, they can actually choose to receive the stablecoin as a settlement mechanism and then credit the funds to the merchants in existing fiat money. Yeah. So ultimately, MasterCard act as the routing layer, the orchestration layer, and don't even really touch the stablecoin. But rather the stablecoin is then sent directly from the issuer to the acquirer.
Yeah, I really enjoy this piece of news, not only in that, at least on an infrastructural level, we now have the 24/7 capability of settling, but I also like it because it's really evidence that blockchain pushes the incumbents. I mean, traditional card settlement didn't run on weekends, holidays, as we all know it. And blockchain's true 24/7 settlement finality, and in particular stablecoins, 24/7 capabilities, really pushed the incumbents, and with that MasterCard and Visa, to expand their capabilities. So I'm not saying this would never have happened otherwise, but I am saying that the emergence of blockchain with its 24/7 capabilities really pushed the incumbents to innovate faster. Yeah, so I think without the emergence of blockchain, we would still operate 10 or 20 years on an infrastructure that doesn't allow 24/7.
We will follow closely also how many of these, or what's the volume ultimately that will be cleared by stablecoins with Visa. They've announced it quite some time ago. I recently read that so far it has not been used so much. Obviously, it depends on the uptake of the issuers and the acquirers, that they agree that they want to use stablecoins. And I think it really depends on a particular product that they might also then sell to the merchants, for example, for intraday payouts or payouts on the weekend. Yeah, for domestic transactions also here, this is possible, for example, with instant payments. But in particular, when the cross-border aspect and the cross-border clearing comes into play, I think here stablecoins could actually fill a gap that so far could not be provided for faster settlement and ultimately the money moving faster into the bank account of the merchants. And yeah, next to announcement that MasterCard wants to use stablecoin rails, there's also been a news that MasterCard, Stripe, and Visa are supposedly working on a new stablecoin. So this is not yet an official statement, but it was widely spread in the news that these companies, among others, also Coinbase, apparently are thinking about forming a consortium to launch a new stablecoin platform that directly competes then also with Circle's USDC and Tether's USDT. This was all based on a CoinDesk article that cited anonymous sources. So there's not yet a formal announcement and no deal, no name, no token structure and so forth that has been disclosed. But it was widely discussed in the news, hence we thought this can also already be included here in the news, even though it's not officially supported. And why is this interesting that these companies come together and think about issuing a new stablecoin? Well, obviously to break this duopoly that we currently see, and eventually also think about new revenue share models, because for example, Coinbase, they profit quite strongly here from USDC, so that would be quite interesting if they really think about forming a new stablecoin. Then clearly the revenue model is interesting, how the distribution share or the revenue share based on the distribution is allocated. Coinbase keeps 100% of the interest income from USDC held on its own exchange and splits the remaining revenue 50-50 for USDC with here a Circle, obviously. And those distribution deals ultimately are the most interesting pieces of the stablecoins, because stablecoins obviously have this very nice interest income that shall then be distributed to those that distribute the stablecoins. So we will definitely also follow that closely. Maybe to summarize the whole part here, where lots of other initiatives have been announced and released, but maybe jumping now also to central banks and commercial banks again. Two news that I also brought with is, first of all, the clearinghouse and its shareholder banks. And they've announced that they now really want to build a settlement infrastructure for settling tokenized deposit transactions of its member banks. So what is the clearinghouse? It's basically a joint venture of major banks that have formed this clearing infrastructure that clears and settles transactions between the different banks, predominantly ACH and faster payment transactions, but it also has a high value transfer settlement infrastructure. So it's comparable to the EBA in Europe, which is also a private institution that settles transactions. And it has direct connectivity into central bank money and therefore can settle between tokenized deposits of the different banks. So here, ultimately, it will work together. It was announced, JP Morgan, Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo were named, but there are other banks also that are shareholders of this joint venture. And they will ultimately build a new network that will somehow connect to the different tokenized deposit platforms of the respective banks, and therefore then allow allegedly 24/7 settlement across the different tokenized deposit platforms. So as our dear listeners obviously know, tokenized deposit platforms lack still the interoperability and the settlement layer between them, predominantly when they are bank-centric or run on bank-centric blockchains. And here is where the clearinghouse wants to target the need for settlement and ultimately provide the settlement kit that stitches together the different bank-centric blockchain networks and therefore then settle in central bank money. So quite an interesting news. It was all over the press, to my view, a bit misrepresented by mentioning all the banks that build together something. My reading and my understanding is that the clearinghouse will provide the settlement network that can then connect to the networks of the banks. So indirectly, the banks are building something, but rather it's the clearinghouse that builds exactly that. And this is ultimately the result of a sprint that has been taking place, I think, earlier this year and was started last year. We reported on it where the Zelle network, which is also a joint network of all the different banks, have been rather focusing then after the outcome of this joint sprint on stablecoins, and the clearinghouse decided to rather focus on settlement of tokenized deposits. And this is now the official announcement that they do plan to provide this network. Yeah, and last but not least, the last news is Enbridge. And we've talked a lot about Enbridge already, which is this joint wholesale CBDC network of different central banks around the world. So here we're talking the Chinese central bank, the central bank from Hong Kong, Thailand, UAE, and Saudi Arabia coming together to build this joint platform for interoperable wholesale CBDCs. There were some test transactions over the last years, but now they really want to commercialize this platform, and China is continuing to take hold of this infrastructure and getting ready for the commercial rollout of this platform that should also support the overall Belt and Road Initiative of China to allow for more efficient settlement of wholesale CBDCs against each other, and therefore also settlement of FX transactions without needing to go through the US dollars as a trading pair, but to offer direct FX between those currencies. They didn't reveal the exact date of the commercial launch, but they said the preparation were advanced and they are working towards the official go-live. Quite interestingly, what has been announced are also figures, which are still rather small, and when you compare it to other settlement figures, they rather seem minuscule. So Enbridge has processed roughly 470 billion yuan, which is about $69 billion in cumulative cross-border settlement, up from 55 billion the Atlantic Council tracked last November, across more than 4,000 transactions. That sounds big, but that's absolutely not big. So a common figure, SWIFT cited that it roughly settles $5 trillion every day globally. Compare that to $69 billion in cumulative cross-border settlement on this platform. And also they estimate to 55 million messages per day. Compare that to the 4,000 transactions that were settled on the platform. So it's absolutely tiny so far. And yeah, also comparable to other settlement systems. So CHIPS, which is actually operated by the clearinghouse that we just talked about, settles 2 trillion per day. And the target system of euros, or the euro system ultimately, settles roughly $3.5 trillion in this case euro, obviously, per day. So yeah, still room to grow, but let's follow that closely, how that will play out, whether these new initiatives can actually scale up and then provide global settlement directly in central bank money between those different central banks. So that was it for the uptake of another month with lots of stablecoin initiatives, but also here again, the uptake of central banks and traditional banks clearing tokenized deposits.
Yeah, thanks for that summary, Manu. Let's now move to regulation, policy, and the public money CBDC debate. There's an interesting question going on in that whole realm. That is, who anchors the tokenized economy, public money or private stablecoins? And there is a transatlantic split that is increasingly getting sharper. In Europe, the ECB laid out its most coherent public money doctrine yet, specifically Mrs. Schnabel and Mrs. Lagarde. Then the Commission opened its first major MiCA review, and the Bank of England finalized a notably conservative stablecoin regime. In turn, in the US, the direction is the mirror image. The Congress is moving to ban a retail CBDC while protecting private dollar stablecoins, and the Fed's own governor frames those stablecoins as an extension of American monetary power rather than a threat. So underneath all that political noise and this transatlantic split, the supervisors are building the cross-border plumbing, specifically EBA or EBA and NYDFS. So it's the same facts, but it's opposite conclusions on the two sides of the Atlantic. It's two mirror image bets on the future of money. Let's now go through them in a bit more detail. And let me start on the European end with ECB's case against stablecoins. So we had even two major ECB speeches in June that taken together amount to so far the most complete public money doctrine the ECB has put out so far. to me. The first was Isabel Schnabel in Seoul on the 1st of June. Her frame was quite brilliant, actually, because she didn't reach for crypto analogies. She reached for money market funds. Her argument is that stablecoins are basically a rerun of the money market fund story from the 1970s onward, and that history tells us exactly what to worry about. Yeah, so one, run risk. When confidence cracks, these instruments are prone to panic redemptions, just like the reserve primary fund breaking the buck in 2008. Then the two, fire sales. So mass redemptions force issuers to dump reserve assets. And if those reserves are government bonds, you get spillover into sovereign debt markets. And her third argument, and this is the specific European twist of her speech, contagion into banks, because under MiCA, stablecoin issuers have to hold a big chunk of reserves, at least 30%, rising to 60% for significant tokens as bank deposits. So a stablecoin collapse transmits straight into the banking sector. Then her fourth argument, distortion of monetary policy, because issuers parking hundreds of billions in short-term T-bills compress yields at the short end of the curve. And five, in her speech, the entrenchment of dollar dominance, since roughly 99% of stablecoins are dollar denominated, depending on the numbers you look at. And second, 2 weeks later then, on June 15th, Christine Lagarde gave a similar, if not same thesis, but with a much bigger frame. She did so at the ECB's own conference called Money in Transition. She opened with the medieval fairs of Champagne, where a divided Europe once settled its accounts as one, which is cool rhetoric, but the substance underneath was really cool. So she brought a killer statistic. That is, the EU still has 32 central securities depositories keeping these records, while the United States has two. That fragmentation is, in her eyes, kind of a disease, and her pitch is that tokenization is the once-in-a-generation chance to build a single settlement layer that is, in her words, complete from the start, rather than trying to weave 32 national systems together after the fact. And critically, she said, the market told the ECB directly, so she listened to the market and heard, more than 60 participants made clear they will not issue digital assets at scale until they can settle in central bank money. That's at least what she proposed. On cross-border, she framed the TIPS interlinking strategy, the life built with India's UPI, the advanced work on the Nexus network in Southeast Asia and Switzerland's SIC IP system, explicitly as the way to take the window out of the dollar stablecoin sales in cross-border payments. Now, my take here is, whatever you think of the conclusions of the two ladies, this is now a fully formed doctrine by the EU, so not a set of nervous warnings here and there. To me, it rests on real monetary theory argument that the risk-free elastic settlement asset has to be public. That's a serious position the community needs to consider, and we should treat it as such. Yeah, so much about these two speeches.
Yeah, and I found them quite interesting and quite remarkable that they now push so strongly against stablecoins and also against euro-denominated stablecoins, right? And I felt that also the BIS has recently, over the last weeks, again further strengthened their arguments against stablecoins. So they also really focus on explaining again that central bank money is the kit that keeps the money single. Yeah, so the singleness of money is always introduced again as a concept that ultimately allows settlement between different issuers, which are banks, obviously, and that they really do not want to see a future where stablecoins play a major role in comparison to deposits settled in central bank money. Yeah, so a much stronger argument against stablecoins that we are now hearing again by the ECB, but also the BIS.
Right. And then there is the MiCA review. So at the same time, the European Commission isn't sitting still on the private side either. So on 20th of May, they opened a consultation on the functioning of MiCA, open until August 31st, with both a public track and a targeted technical track. People are already calling this MiCA version 2, and it's the most significant European crypto consultation since the original work back in 2019. Our dear former guest, Patrick Hansen's read on the live question is worth flagging. He had a cool LinkedIn post. So the big one is multi-issuer stablecoin structures. MiCA version 1 assumed one token, one legal issuer, but global stablecoin infrastructure increasingly uses distributed issuer structures across jurisdictions. So this is about whether global issuers can even operate cleanly in the EU. Yeah. And then there's the economic viability of asset referent tokens, where the version 1 requirements are arguably so strict they're commercially unworkable. Also an argument I heard at the Point Zero Forum. Then there's the DeFi angle, so staking and lending gray zone that version one mostly punted on. And then there's the line between e-money tokens and tokenized deposits, which matters as European banks build their own on-chain payment instruments. So where is the line to be drawn here? And then ultimately, also in Europe, we have a move by the EBA and the New York DFS. There is a MOU, a memorandum of understanding between the two entities, which came on the 2nd of June. So the European Banking Authority signed such a memorandum of understanding with the New York State Department of Financial Services on supervising cross-border stablecoin activity. This is under Article 126 of MiCA, which lets the EBA strike information sharing agreements with third country supervisors. Yeah, so actually quite interesting, because this cross-country supervision is fairly new, at least to me, right? We have Genius and Clarity in the US, we have MiCA in the EU, but really this cross-continental or cross-jurisdiction regulation is something required in the crypto space, the institutional DLT space, but only early signs of it show up now, right? With this memorandum of understanding, so no worries, no big regulatory moves here, it's an MOU, nothing more.
Yeah, but it goes into the same direction as also the BIS has stressed a lot now over the last days. And I think in their yearly economic report, they also spend some pages on that there's a need for stronger cooperation between the different regulators in the respective jurisdictions to regulate stablecoins jointly and to harmonize ultimately the stablecoin regulation, because they are global instruments. And if you don't want to go into a direction where there's domestic regulated smart contracts ultimately that issue the stablecoin, so for example a euro or Europe USDC and the USA USDC, where those two need to be exchanged against each other when they are traded or when they are transferred across borders, then you need this harmonized regulation, because ultimately then the stablecoin is can continue to function as a global bearer instrument. So it goes hand in hand with the stronger push of the BIS to further harmonize the global regulations.
All right, and to conclude the European angle of policy, regulation, and public money, let's also take a look at the Bank of England, which finalizes a systemic stablecoin regime. On the 22nd of June, the Bank of England published its final policy statement and the draft code of practice for systemic stablecoin issuers. Yeah, and the headline here is a real U-turn from what they consulted on last year. So remember, the original proposal had this £20,000 holding cap per individual. The idea was to stop people pulling deposits out of commercial banks and parking them in stablecoins, which would hit the banking system's ability to land. This is now reversed. Instead, they are introducing a temporary issuance guardrail of 40 billion pounds per systemic stablecoin. So rather than policing every individual wallet, they are capping the total size of each coin. Same policy goal here, but really protecting credit provision, but in their words, cheaper and easier to implement, and allows unrestricted use by households and businesses. Yeah, so cool pivot here, I think. Importantly, they've said this guardrail gets reviewed regularly and removed once the risk to lending is dealt with. All right, so much about the European side. And now let's really move to the US angle, where the US Senate passes a housing bill with a four-year Fed CBDC ban. So on the 22nd of June, the US Senate passed the 21st Century Road to Housing Act by 85 votes to 5. It's primarily an affordable housing bill, the most significant housing legislation decades in the States, restricting Wall Street from buying up single-family homes and funding new construction. But buried inside it is a clause that bans the Federal Reserve from issuing a central bank digital currency until the end of 2030. So this is really interesting. The irony is that the Fed wasn't building one. So this is legislation against something that barely exists beyond a research topic. After 2030, any digital dollar would need explicit congressional authorization. There's a deliberate carve out for permissionless private dollar tokens. So Circle's USDC and Tether's USDT are untouched. I mean, they aren't CBDCs after all anyways. The framing from Republican lawmakers is that a CBDC is a surveillance tool and a threat to the commercial banking model. Yeah, so it's not fully law yet. Trump is reportedly delaying his signature, trying it to a separate elections bill, the Save America Act. But the direction is ever more clear in the United States, and it builds on Trump's January 2025 executive order against a digital dollar and a new Fed chair worth calling a CBDC a bad policy decision during his confirmation.
Yeah, Michi, as you said, in order to get something like a CBDC done in the US, it would need to go through Congress. And given that there is already a executive order being signed by Trump, I wouldn't have expected that a retail CBDC will ever come, right? But now here in this Housing Act, there's this very clause that prevents the Fed to issue a CBDC. The key question is, does it include a wholesale CBDC as well, right? And I think I've read also some interpretations that tokenized reserves, for example, are still possible. And that's also the lingo that has been used by Fed governors and Fed officials that are talking about wholesale CBDCs, given that CBDC is such a burned name, or ultimately you cannot use CBDC anymore. You need to call it tokenized reserve. Quite an interesting move now. Let's see. Because ultimately, the Fed is also participating in Project Agora, where there's obviously a need for issuing a wholesale CBDC or tokenized reserves. And that seems to be still feasible.
Yeah, so my take, after all, they are banning something the Fed never was building. So there is no real CBDC project. So this is rather symbolic, but it really cements a public money divergence in the States. So no. If it wasn't clear to you, now it is. No CBDC in the US. All right, then also updates on Clarity. The Clarity Act cleared Senate banking 15-9, building on the Genius Act from July 2025. So it enshrines stablecoins as a distinct category, quote-unquote, permitted payment stablecoins. It hands the CFTC primary authority over spot crypto commodities like Bitcoin, and it leaves securities with the SEC. It's finally drawing a line under that whole turf war. Yeah. There is one interesting detail to watch. It bans paying direct interest on simply holding a stablecoin, which is a win for the bank lobby in the States worried about deposit flight. But it allows transaction-based rewards. So analysts put a final 2026 passage at roughly 50-50. So you know my take already. If the world power number one and the largest economy finally rolls out its first market structure regulation for blockchain, then I'm happy they take their time and they negotiate it carefully. Yeah, some critics criticize or complain that it's taking so long, but I think it's good. This is carefully negotiated. Yeah. Good. And this brings us to the ultimate news in the US. On the 31st of May, Fed Governor Christopher Waller was speaking in Dubrovnik. He said the spread of dollar stablecoins around the world will broaden the reach of US monetary policy. His exact framing is countries that adopt them are, quote unquote, like a fixed exchange rate system importing US monetary conditions. Now, sit with that for a second, because it's really the perfect mirror of Schnabel and Lagarde, who also had speeches. It's the same facts, like 97 to 99% of stablecoins are dollar denominated. They hold hundreds of billions in T-bills. But it's two opposite conclusions. The ECB sees dollar stablecoins as a sovereignty threat and a driver of uncontrolled digital dollarization. The Fed, which now Waller's speech shows, looks at the same phenomenon and sees a feature, not a bug. So free demand for short-term treasuries that lowers US borrowing costs and the digital entrenchment of dollar dominance, especially in emerging markets. So one continent's threat is another continent's strategic asset. And so you may want to contrast further the three speeches, two on Europe's end and one on the US end with Waller. Yeah, and with that, we close the policy, regulation, and public money debate on the two sides of the continents. Manu, anything to add from your end on this whole?
Yeah, I mean, on the last point, just surprisingly direct, Waller has already been in the past very, very direct about his support of stablecoins, and also that ultimately it entrenches the role of the US dollar, and also that it allows for disbursement of US debt into the world and diversify the holders of US debt also to retail users. And you might think that in other parts of the world, this would be an imagination of what the motives are, but here they are very, very clearly stated again. It's not a secret what the ultimate interest of the US government to back stablecoins is. It's about additional disbursement of US dollar debt and obviously to manifest the role of the US dollar in the global economy. Yeah. So those fears of ECB and Schnabel cannot be wiped away by dismissing them as fear. No, there are clear statements from Fed governors now as well. Okay.
Alrighty, let's close our June news analysis, if you will, with our knowledge bites. Manu, what do you recommend our audience to further consume?
Yes, so I brought a BIS working paper by Fabian Scher, Anneke Kosse, Tara Rice, and Takeshi Shirakami. And yeah, Fabian Scher is likely also not an unknown person here to many of you listening to this podcast. He is a researcher and professor at the University of Basel that focuses a lot on public permissionless infrastructure and yeah, blockchain in general. And here now issuing a very interesting paper, the Anatomy of Stablecoin Transactions, where he basically analyzes 590 million events from 141 million Ethereum transactions across Tether, USDC, and PayPal. And his takeaways are quite interesting. And I would highly encourage to go through that paper if you're interested in how stablecoins are actually used. Because he basically finds out, or the authors found out, that complex transactions that emit multiple transfer events are roughly 60% of all stablecoin transfers, which means that smart contracts are interacting with each other and therefore orchestrating rather complex transactions, sometimes up to 1,000 steps that are orchestrated via DeFi protocols, for example. Yeah. So interpreting each transfer as a standalone payment really misclassifies then almost 6 out of 10 transfers events that also overstate both stablecoin transfer counts and transferred volumes. And that is quite interesting because we already see, for example, by Visa, adjusted stablecoin volume flows. BCG has issued a paper on that very recently to dive deeper into how stablecoins are actually used and what's the fraction of the real-world payment flows that those that are interested in how stablecoins are adopted, for example, in B2B cross-border payments, look at. Yeah. So here, again, stablecoins are rather used in complex transactions across multiple hops in DeFi. And Fabian Scher and colleagues are portraying that very nicely here in this paper.
Thank you so much, Manu. It's definitely on my list. I appreciate Fabian Scher's and his co-authors thinking a lot and his writing. Now, moving on to to my knowledge bite, for our German speakers, I want to flag a really sharp bite. It's episode 385 of Daniel Stelter's BTO podcast called Einfach überflüssig, der digitale Euro. So it's the perfect counterweight to everything we just discussed. We spent this whole or a major part of the episode laying out the ECB's case for public money. This episode is the serious, well-argued case against the digital euro, against public money. So listen to it precisely to stress test Europe's narrative, or at least ECB's narrative. His guest is Volker Wieland, professor of monetary economics and director of the IMFS at Goethe University Frankfurt, so one of Germany's leading monetary theorists. It's a heavyweight academic who gave formal testimony to the Bundestag. And his one-liner to remember is this: the digital euro is a solution searching for a problem. And his point is, what does it actually solve when you can already pay cashless with card, SEPA, instant or Vero? Yeah. So enjoy this episode, at least for our German speakers, as the recording is in German. Good. Thank you for listening to BFRR and for making it until the end of this slightly longer episode. Thank you to you, Manuel, for your super interesting takes and insights. And if you enjoy the podcast and the session, please recommend and rate us. That helps us the most. Yeah, make sure to subscribe and join us next week when we'll be exploring another critical development in the evolution of digital finance. Until then, this is Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll, bringing Europe's perspective on digital money and digital assets to the world.
Thanks, Michi. And thanks, dear listeners. Talk soon and hear soon. Bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.